possible under late capitalism. It's not possible to just say that because we fed people today that they will be okay tomorrow. It's giving them the tools, fixing the immediate needs, giving the tools, and then long-term staying with them so that they can help build and then be the example for the next.
Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Renee Feltz and to Tish Stringer for that report from Houston, Texas, and to Austin Airwaves, always. That does it for our show. Juan, tonight you're going to be in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
Juan is continuing his book tour with his new book, Reclaiming Gotham. He'll be at Busboys and Poets at 5th and K in Washington, D.C., speaking with
Joe Davidson, the columnist at the Washington Post.
And then moving on Thursday to Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe, Arizona at 7 p.m. On Friday, Juan will be speaking in Austin, Texas at 5:30 at the Workers' Defense Project. And in the weeks to come, he's headed to Newark, New Jersey, Kansas City, Missouri, College Park, Maryland, and beyond. You can check our website at democracynow.org. I'll also be traveling through Canada in the weeks to come. Check democracynow.org, our speaking events. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzman, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Trina Ndura, Nat Needham. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Coming up this morning on KBOO at 8, it's Abe and Joe speaking with Curtis Acosta on education. This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 8 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag FuzzyBoo and you'll be entered to win a chance to have FuzzyBoo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/FuzzyBoo.
Good morning!
Yeah, okay, we were drumming on the table.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry about that, folks, but, you know, Santana.
That's right, Santana.
Come on.
All right, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM on your radio dial. If you're listening on one of the internet tubes, there's many, many internet tubes. This one is called KBOO.FM. Now, we've got a slight diversion from our typical fare this morning.
We do?
Yeah. We're going to turn away from natural disasters. From man-made disasters, from electoral disasters, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
We're going to turn to education in one of our Western states.
We don't need no education.
Yeah, we do.
We don't need
Everybody
no
does.
Thought control.
Specifically, we're going to talk about a fascinating court case that recently transpired in the state of Arizona. Specifically, we're going to turn to the story of an innovative program that arose in the 1990s in Tucson called the Mexican American Studies Program, or MAS for short. This was an attempt to...
Is that Moss like Moore?
Yeah, I think that's how it's pronounced. We can ask our guest about that in just a moment. This program was an attempt to instill into the public school curricula a robust course in Mexican American history and culture and literature and on and on and on.
Hey, hey, we stole a third of Mexico fair and square.
Well, that's a debatable point. Also, along with this program came a more rigorous academic standard, higher expectations for students, and ultimately this translated into dramatically increased graduation rates amongst Latino students. And this was, by virtually any measure, an incredibly successful program, which is, of course, why the Arizona State Legislature tried to shut it down. So to tell us more about this program and about the court case and about the larger question of the suppression of non-mainstream cultural and academic studies is our guest today, Dr. Curtis Acosta, one of the founders of the Mexican American Studies program. Curtis, welcome to the Abe and Joe Show.
Hey, thank you very much, Abe. It's good to hear from you, brother.
Yeah, it's good to hear your voice, too. Now, full disclosure, Curtis and I go way back to high school, and we were roommates in college. So there you have it. Wow. All cards on the table. It's good to hear your voice, man.
Yeah, same here.
So why don't we start by having you give us a little bit of background on the Mexican American Studies program first, and then talk to us about how this whole court business came to be.
Yes. You did a great intro. The research was perfect, and almost felt like, hey, I don't need to be here.
Well, hey, thanks for joining us.
So out of a community, a response to the community, the school district, Tucson Unified School District, created the Mexican American Studies Department in the late 90s. So this is community activism in the mid-90s. At that time, it's important to remember, to go back a little further, that there was unfortunately, a desegregation lawsuit that the district is still under. So that was brought to the federal courts in the late 70s. And here we are in 2017, and it's still very much a part of daily business for TUSD. Part of that, the two plaintiffs were, there was an African-American plaintiff and there was a Mexican-American plaintiff. They came together and jointly filed a suit. And out of that became the formation of African American Studies. And to that point, we didn't have, up into the 90s, so we're talking nearly 20 years later, there wasn't a Mexican American Studies component. There were different remedies from the courts that that instituted the African American Studies Department, but not a Mexican American Studies Department. And so it just seemed natural that that there be, because of Tucson, because I believe our school district is pushing 70% or over Latino students at this point. It's always had a high population of Mexicana, Mexicano, Chicana, Chicano, Latina, Latino, I'll use all of them, students. And so to form a department specifically for the purposes of instruction and curriculum as well as other services, was important. And so every one of these ethnic studies departments, because two more were created after that, the Native American Studies Department, actually I think that was around prior to us, and then the Pan-Asian Studies Department. So we had four ethnic studies departments. They were all autonomous, which was really important. So for our Mexican American Studies Department, we decided that the first way of intervening rather than doing like dropout prevention and things like that, the best dropout prevention was courses, with school. This was rigorous study, as you said, and rigorous study upon curriculum that reflected their community, reflected their culture, reflected their family heritage and history, reflected their lives, and that's what we did. And we based much of this on the history of ethnic studies, you know, of course, coming from San Francisco State in the late 60s and moving throughout the West, for sure, those days, but also research that was being produced, educational research that was being produced, much more contemporary research about how to what they say call close the achievement gap, and so we reduced that all of our means and created the department and created the courses.
So this was a response, I'm guessing here, to the fact that, and I'm painting with a broad brush here. So students in Tucson schools were receiving in history class, for example, the traditional narrative about the United States that was almost entirely based in around Anglo figures, right? That the country was formed by white people, that white people acting through manifest destiny expanded westward. And so you had, I'm guessing, the classic case of students sitting in class realizing that none of the people they were studying about looked anything like them, none of the authors they were reading looked anything like them, and none of the curricula addressed their experience of the lives they were living in their skins in the place where they were.
Yeah.
Correct.
Can I just say one thing that I think is really important here in a meta sense, which is that the American history is generally taught is a history of magic. It is a presumption that there was when we talk about manifest destiny, it suggests that somehow a god, the god, intervened in the process, legitimized the slaughter of Native American peoples, legitimized the war against Mexico, which was a nonsense thing to get more land for more, mostly for slavery, legitimized all of the kinds of things that we know to be the fundamental injustices in the creation of the nation, all legitimized by the magic notion of God's will. I just wanted to say that.
No, that's really important, and it's something that we would get in trouble for later, is exactly what you just said, Joe. That was deemed as resentment towards race or class of people, which we'll get into. That was part of the law that was created to end our classes. So that basic truth that you brought up, and a very important truth to have a critical, perspective towards our history and critical lens towards, the creation of these borders and our democracy. That was something that the detractors in the state of Arizona, the public officials in our state, were really hypersensitive to. Let's just put it that way.
Let me
go back to what Abe was saying. Absolutely. So not only was the curriculum Eurocentric, as you brought up, Abe, but also, our students were doing poorly. That was really the main reason, right? This is generational disengagement. Generational low expectations, generations of a, what we call a deficit perspective, towards Mexican Americans, towards Latinos, towards and as we know, towards other folks of color. So that was really, it was our understanding and belief, from our own experiences and from the literature, that if the students saw themselves, they would become more engaged, and thus we would be going at the heart of the matter, which is, instead of having an assimilationist mindset, we were going to be more responsive to their cultural heritage and history, while simultaneously being respectful to the fact that they're American. So it wasn't like we were throwing things out. We were doing a more comparative approach, but we privileged the voices from of authors of color, of the history of Mexican Americans in this country, and then we would go to the more traditional approach and use that as the comparison. And that was, again, something that, although very effective as far as changing the lives and the trajectory of students' educational journeys and creation of their academic identity, was very unpopular from the perspective of the traditionalists in our state government.
Why do you think that was? What exactly got under their skin about this program?
Well, I think, so to speak. There's a couple. There's kind of a more like temporal answer for from the moment in time, but there's also like the historical answer. So I'll leave the historical answer first. Joe sounds like a hell of a historian, so maybe he'll dig it. Just the creation of Arizona itself as a state, splitting off from New Mexico, and was in part because the European American population didn't want to be wanted to split away from the New Mexican power at the time, the governmental power. So there's a long history in this neck of the woods of anti-Mexican, anti-Latino, and now anti-immigrant sentiment. And I think that is really, we had an expert witness. He's from Harvard. an amazing historian, Stephen Pitty. Actually, AB's from our neck of the woods. He grew up, went to Jesuit High in Sacramento.
Oh, no kidding.
So, yeah, so it was crazy, like, you know, how all these things came together. But he did an amazing comprehensive examination of Chicana, Chicano, or Mexican American educational history for our case, and he was able to highlight that there are these code words that have been used over generations that really that are based in racial animus. And so that's the historical part, right? And we could go back to that deeper if we want later. But really, what we were seeing in the mid-2000s was this the immigration debate was starting to come into full bloom. It hit Arizona a lot earlier than that, but it was and it's hit our nation since then. But it was in 2006 that Dolores Huerta came to the civil rights hero. Came to Tucson High, the school where I taught, and she gave a speech. She had a really interesting analysis for the students about how she believed that the immigration debate was actually a distraction from the war efforts in Afghanistan and the Middle East.
Hmm.
And I hadn't heard that before. That's why it always stuck out to me. And then she said the infamous phrase. She says, if you look at all the legislation that's going, the anti-immigration legislation that's happening is coming from Republicans. Then she said the infamous phrase, because Republicans hate Latinos. And that hit like wildfire all over like Fox News, O'Reilly Factor. And this is the mid-2000s. This is 2006. So that is when the full attention of our state officials upon our program became known, you know, because they were aware, they became aware of, well, who invited her. And although it was a coalition of different groups in our city, including the University of Arizona, Pima College, it really boiled down to what's this Mexican American Studies program. And our state superintendent at the time, Tom Horn, made it a very strong part of his platform at the time to get rid of our classes.
So the Arizona State Legislature, responding to charges that Republicans hate Latinos, decided that the best response was to then punish Latino students.
It took them a while, but yeah, eventually they actually had a 3 legislative attempts. It was the third one that actually passed the House and Senate and was signed by then Governor Brewer in 2010. So that's already a 4-year stretch of attacks where we were getting hammered in the media pretty regularly, and the theory that they were using on us is pretty common. They otherized us, they made us seem like we're foreign. Anti-American was a huge part of this entire campaign against our program, against our students. And then they just totally, once our effectiveness as far as graduation rates and test scores were fully vetted, then they changed the debate. The goalposts kept changing. Can you believe that? I know.
Right.
Changed the goalposts, kept moving them. And then it just became, I'll never forget when Tom Horn said, this isn't about education, it's about values. I'm like, oh no, here we go. Now it's a street fight. Because we had all the logic, we had everything on our side. There was no complaints from Tucson. It was a Phoenix, you know, agitation. There was our students were doing great. They were matriculating into college at a rate that we had never seen. But that all of a sudden, all of that didn't matter. What mattered was we don't like it.
Yeah.
And it's just about value.
I'm going to interrupt, if I may, just really quickly. I don't know what our audience up here knows about the history of the relationship between Mexico, the country, and the United States. But just briefly, we created in 1846 essentially a war which was designed, I think I mentioned this earlier, but was designed essentially to increase the available land for slavery. And this had been a large issue in larger contexts throughout the period leading up to the Civil War. But more important than that, perhaps, was the treaty that we made with Mexico, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which promised a number of things as kind of making it okay. Among the promises were the old traditional Spanish land grants would be honored, the language, Spanish, would be honored, the traditions of the religion, Catholicism, would be honored, and a whole host of other issues. During the period directly after that war, Every single one of those agreement elements were either abrogated or destroyed in some way or another, as you well know. And in the end, what happened was that we created a second class or even third class of people who were supposed to be citizens, for example, who often were like braceros, brought in purely to do labor, and it was expected they would then leave. And this leads directly into the situation we're in now, where we have a president who hates Hispanics.
That's it. You know, Joe, I'm ready to, let's do this. Let's start creating. I know Oregon's moving forward and towards ethnic studies. Let's do this. See, I mean, you have an unbelievable scope of our history down here in the Southwest. It's tremendously important, and it's unique, to be honest, because our own students didn't know what you just said. Their families, their parents, for generations. It's important for folks, especially up in the Northwest, to realize that we have the old school phrase of we didn't cross the border crossed us. There are families here in Tucson that have been here for centuries.
Really?
And they've had like four or five flags over them. The understanding that you just showed us in the history of the breaking of yet another treaty by the United States government is something that should be studied by every Arizonan, and it's not. It's purposefully limited and minimized, and knowing the history really helps, like all the rest of making sense of where you are, who you are, and how you came to be. And then it also helps frame, what are the best ways to transform these situations? For instance, like if we just fast forward to now, a lot of our students, they're impoverished. They're working poor. You come from families that are doing the best they can, but the jobs available to them are not. They're not going to help them ascend quickly. So we have, and there's a false notion that those parents don't care about education. And if you look at Latino demographics, every time there's a presidential election, you'll see education is top three. It's only been supplanted lately by immigration as one of the top issues, and it's actually much higher than consistently than European American folks or how some people say white folks would when it comes to education being a priority for an election.
Yeah,
so there are these myths out there about our families, and knowing your history will help you transform your future. And that's what we were seeing. It was multi-generational. Our parents were really involved in our students' lives. Another thing that you'll hear from mainstream educators that's an impossibility is another deficit lens that is cast upon our families.
I also think, just a couple things, that because I actually grew up in Southern California and went to high school in San Diego, I became aware, just as a kind of naive kid, of the whole culture of fear around Mexican Americans. There was, of course, during World War II, a series of riots called the Zoot Suit Riots, which were essentially an attack on Mexican Americans. There was the whole question of the Pachuco movement, that is the notion, as you remember, maybe, or have read about, the notion that there was somehow this evil underworld operating out of Mexico, out of the city of Pachuco, actually, that was the thing that was so frightening to the Anglo culture. And it, of course, made it difficult for people who were Hispanic to be in part of the armed forces during World War II, hence unpatriotic. This was a very violent thing that took place with a terrible riot involving burning and beating and stripping people of their clothing and rapes in the Los Angeles area, encouraged by the Navy and by the Army.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And, I was actually the literature teacher, but you see how far I've come learning my own history. I knew none of the things you're talking about, Joe, growing up where Abe and I went to high school. And even in the Bay Area, before I moved, before high school, it wasn't prolific to learn about any Mexican-American history. So it's the simple fact is, like, the Zoot Suit Riots that you just talked about, you know, we had an amazing unit and collaboration between my social studies partner and myself. I would teach the play Zoot Suit by Luis Valdez. He would teach the history, and our students would have this unbelievable scope of what their grandparents went through, right?
Mm-hmm.
Claiming their identity. And then as Mexican-Americans, as Chicanas and Chicanos, it was fabulous. And they were going home, and they were having these discussions with their nanas and their tatas, their abuelos, and they were sharing things that we dream about as educators. You know, it was becoming one of those things that people think is false, that can't happen, you know, that's a myth. But that really engaged students going home and sharing knowledge. And a lot of times the grandparents lived it, but they didn't know the political dynamics that were happening behind it, and it affirmed some of their own suspicions as being true. And so there was just a tremendous amount of freedom. It was inspiring to learn about yourself, to learn about your grandparents and parents in a rigorous academic way. And that just fed. It just fed upon itself, right? It just became an addictive place to be. And it was a really powerful time.
Well, clearly the legislature needed to step in and do something about that. Clearly. It's fascinating to me, but I got to say, not surprising that this all came to pass in the state of Arizona, which has kind of been a flashpoint for this sort of thing for a long time. You have the Minuteman movement arising in Arizona. Of course, you've got Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Maricopa County. You have things like the state rescinding Martin Luther King Day, and on and on and on. What's going on in Arizona that is engendering such hostility to something as innocuous as Mexican-American studies?
Well, it's a tradition.
It's the family business. Yeah.
So, you know, there's that commercial about the master. It's a tradition like no other. Yeah, trust us. We got a tradition like no other down here. And there's also a tradition of resistance and a tradition of humanity and a tradition of humanizing one another. So, before I get to the darker spots, I think I want to shine some light on some beautiful things. It's like when I first moved to Tucson, it was right after I left Willamette, right after I graduated. I should say that. Graduated from Willamette. And I came down here, and it was the first place I felt like you could be Mexican outside, right? Like it was a part of the culture, it was affirmed. It wasn't just in your house. It wasn't just in secret. It wasn't just in your neighborhood. It was like it was pretty prevalent. So there's some beautiful things, and that's because what I call old school Tucsonans are Tucsonenses to me. That's how you say it in Spanish, Tucsonenses. And so there were a lot of folks that came who are of European descent, right, generationally, you know, heritage-wise, who came here and, became a part of that culture, you know, and created, you know, cultures came together, not just clashing. And there was a real respect and love for the culture in this town. And so it's interesting because that's what attracted me to staying here, that and being able to teach. For the first time in my life, when I was a majority in the classroom, it was as a teacher. When I stood in front of a class and there were mostly brown folks learning. And then I realized that there were some perspectives in the faculty lounge that were really deficit towards folks that looked like my cousin, you know, children that looked like my cousins or me or whomever, people I love, my sister. And so I was like, no, I got to stick this out. This is why I have to be here. And so there were a tremendous amount of folks who, diverse, ethnically diverse in other ways as well, and that have embraced what Tucson can be in its most beautiful moment. At the same time, what I've noticed over the last 20 years or so is white flight, to be quite honest. Like there were the more segregated schools, more segregated areas of town. We have a couple different parts of like the outskirts of town, suburban neighborhoods that became very attractive for folks around the country to move. So what we've seen is we're like a receiving community constantly for two different newcomers, right? Folks from Mexico and Latin America mostly, and also folks from all over the country who maybe didn't grow up with Latinos and Mexicanos and Chicanos, right? So like from the Midwest, because, you know, our property value is pretty reasonable down here. You could get a nice home and it's pretty, and you know, 9 months out of the year you can wear shorts.
And the winters are warm,
Right, yeah. So I mean, it's really attractive. Golf, all this stuff, right? There's this other part of Tucson that I don't really, that's not my Tucson. You know, I came because of the students, the cultura, the taquerias, all of that, right? And it made me feel whole. But there's another part, which is, you know, the resort culture and whatnot, and no shade against that. It can be beautiful. But but there's these enclaves now in Tucson, very separatist kind of enclaves. And we're seeing this across the United States, too. This isn't a Tucson phenomenon. And they went their own schools, and they want their own districts, and it's breaking apart that kind of carpiotada, that kind of stew that we had before in Tucson, where folks were growing up in a less segregated schooling environment. And I think, unfortunately, Abe, that actually enhances the separatist kind of mentality, because you're not running into folks. You've never, you know, you could have grown up in, say, Iowa, right, and move to Tucson. You love it here, but you never interact with Mexicanos and Chicanos, which are a huge part of the spine and the history of Arizona. And then your children go to school, and they're hearing that Mexican American studies is evil and this, that, and the other thing. And then it becomes kind of this. And I go back to what Joe said. It's an old school recipe. It's an old school cocktail of, you know, just engender fear in the dark folks, and that'll get you far politically. And I, unfortunately, there's all these ramifications. So just really quickly, I'm a U of A, University of Arizona South professor now, and I have students in my classes who are prospective teachers that tell me that they'd love to teach, you know, a unit on Mexican American studies, but it's banned, Dr. Acosta. And I'm like, no, that's not true. Our program was banned, but the concept of it isn't, and that misinformation is deadly.
I want to take care of a little business here quickly, and then I want to get back to the court case itself. So coming up this morning on KBOO at 9, an alternative radio professor of economics emeritus at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, Richard Wolff, looks at capitalism versus socialism. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Intersections Radio, Renee Denfeld talks about her book, The Child Finder, as well as her work on behalf of sex trafficking victims and people who have been wrongly imprisoned. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, Joseph Galavan presents the second half of his special on TBA 17, that's the time-based art festival, featuring interviews with Aaron Boberg and Roya Amir Soleil Moni, apologies for pronunciation there.
Apologies all this for pronunciation and pronunciation.
That's right. All this and more coming up today on KBOO, your listener-supported community radio station. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program. The number to call to take part in this conversation, 503-231-8187. If you can't get to the phone, we'll take your written comments on our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Abe and Joe. And also over the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. We are talking with Dr. Curtis Acosta, an educator and activist from Arizona, one of the founders of the Mexican American Studies program in Tucson, which was declared illegal under a law passed by the Arizona legislature, which in turn found to be unconstitutional later by, in fact, this past summer by a federal court. So let's talk about that court case a little more, Curtis, if we could. First of all, so you said the legislature made two abortive attempts to outlaw this program and things like it, and finally succeeded the third time around. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And what was on what grounds did they oppose the Mexican American Studies program in Tucson?
So if we go back to the actual language of the bill that passed, let me go back to the language of the first bill. It's way more exciting. So that's all exciting, but this is even more exciting. So we had, you mentioned Joe Arpaio. One of Joe Arpaio's biggest supporters in during this time was the president of the Senate. And you got to, at this time, we were talking about 2008 to 2010, and it was Russell Pierce. And I'm not sure if y'all remember Russell Pierce. I bet you back in a few years ago you remembered him. But this is a man who was very popular in Mesa, that's where he's from, and he was getting elected pretty easily. And he was also had white supremacist friends, like literally like pictures of him with white supremacists at marches and stuff and things as, such as that. And that in our state, apparently up there, was okay. You know, this was known. This was well known. So Russell Pierce was part of the first collective of legislators, including our state superintendent, Tom Horn, at the time, that were trying to create legislation to ban our program. And the initial attempts, I remember reading the initial ones, I always got him first or second, like with me and my other colleague. We always got, somehow they found us quick first. But I remember when I was reading it, I'm like, uh-oh. And then all of a sudden I said, it says, you know, the purpose of education is to inculcate Western values. And I was like, oh, okay, I think we're going to be all right on this one, because that's just too blatant. But at the time, we also had he had a supermajority. And the Tea Party had pretty much taken over Arizona politics. It was the governing party. And there was even a split between the old school, like McCain-type Republicans, there was tensions with them and the Tea Party Republicans. And Russell Pierce was the flag bearer of the Tea Party Republicans. Anyway, long story short, the first attempts were a little just, you know, too racist. They're too, I mean, blatantly... talking about inculcating Western values, and thus all of us that are, you know, talk about this country as one of its strengths being that it has, you know, it's multilingual, multicultural, it's bringing folks all together to work together. That is being critiqued within the bill. So that one didn't pass, and then the next one wasn't much better. It was a little better, but it wasn't much better. But finally, they scrubbed out all that language. And that's when we kind of knew we were in trouble. So to answer your question, if we look at the language of the bill that did pass, the first thing was it was about fining school districts 10% of their monthly apportionment for any program that taught the overthrow of the American government, that that was designed for a race or class of people, that taught resentment towards a race or class of people, and the last one was taught ethnic solidarity instead of teaching pupils that they are individuals. So actually, individualism was mandated through this law as the only way to teach in students in Arizona. And that's an understated one part of the bill, because the other three were really got a lot more flashpoint.
Now, I've known you for a long time, Curtis, and I'm guessing you weren't teaching the overthrow of the federal government.
No. In fact, you know, that's the only one they didn't use against us in the multiple times they tried to fight. They had to do multiple attempts to find us in violation, and we can talk about that, because that was actually one of the reasons why, one of the big reasons why we won this case finally this summer, is that they had to do multiple attempts to find violation. But they never used that one. But what Dr. Pitty found out, what he analyzed, the Yale historian who was our expert witness as far as history, he said that by including it in the bill, it was there for a purpose. It was there for folks to remind folks that we are, that's really who these people are. Mm-hmm. Even though we're not going to find them in violation of that, he said it was part of those code words used as foreigners that want to overthrow the government. And so it stayed with you, and it stayed in their talking points, right? Regardless of us them not using it to find us in violation.
Seems also so, like a way to remind everyone who's in charge, and don't forget
exactly.
It.
Exactly. For sure.
We've got a caller standing by. If we could feel like taking a call here, Curtis?
Yeah, sure.
All right. We got LJ. How you doing, LJ?
Hey, what's up?
Hey, thank how you doing?
For the dialogue. I'll just make this really brief. One of the books that were forbidden to be read was Pedagogy of the Oppressed by Paulo Freire. I'm not an educator. I'm just a line cook, but I did read the book, and it's can you discuss about the importance of Pedagogy of the Oppressed? and I'll take my answers off the air.
Hey, thank you for the call. I'm not familiar with that work, Joe. Pedagogy of the Oppressed, Curtis.
Oh, I am, but I don't want to. I don't want to get. It's a long discourse.
It's a long discourse.
I don't want to start on that.
I'll give a shorter one.
Okay.
So we use selections of Pedagogy of the Oppressed pretty much chapter two. Chapter two is like the real golden chapter of that book. And before I move on any further, Pedagogy of the Oppressed for teacher preparation programs is probably the most widely used text in all of the United States. So it's what we use constantly, consistently across this nation as far as teaching what came out of that book, a body of a theory of knowledge called critical pedagogy, a theory of educational and pedagogical practice called critical pedagogy. And so critical pedagogy pretty much boils down to just being aware of inequalities and being able to analyze inequalities in your life so that you can transform them. And so it's a critical consciousness, in other words. And so, yes, the book was on the list. It was actually confiscated in front of our students. I don't know if that was the book confiscated in front of my students, but as TUSD, the school district, adhered to the violation and the ruling from the government at that time, meaning the state superintendent violation on a program, that one of their reactions was to ban books. So they banned seven titles, critical pedagogy being one of them. They boxed them up, and some of them they actually boxed in front of my students.
Wow!
And it was. There's so many little stories within this larger story that are just unbelievably anti-American, and we were the ones being called anti-American. So it's pretty fascinating. But so we use chapter two in our government classes as a launching point for them to look at to build their research projects. And we had what's called youth participatory action research. That's a real geeky term in the educational field. But what it is it's pretty much community responsive projects that you're using to make, you know, research that you're using to actually come out of that with something that drives an action item that drives your community towards something better, towards some positive transformation. And so it was used as creating, you know, a lens and dialogue for the students to start looking around at their own experiences and the experiences of the community and the Mexican American experience or African American experience, whomever was feeling the crush of I would say, you know, oppression or of the lack of freedom they may be feeling towards their own you know, status and station in the United States. And so it was pretty much used in that fashion.
All right. Once again, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So last month, a federal court ruled in favor of the Mexican American Studies program. I presume that that you guys didn't waste a whole lot of time in challenging this law. It was, even from a layman's perspective, it seems pretty obviously unconstitutional. And a federal judge... Go ahead.
We challenged it in the same year that it was signed by the governor. So in the fall of 2010, we officially challenged it in federal court.
And then last month, U.S. District Judge Wallace A. Toshima found that the law violated both the First and 14th Amendments in attempting to deny to students this sort of curricula. In reading about this case, I mean, it's fascinating, some of the smaller stories, as you put it earlier, that were going on. You mentioned earlier the state superintendent of public instruction, Tom Horn. He was succeeded by a guy named John Hoppenthal. And Hoppenthal went on to post some racially charged and anonymous posts on his blog that really helped to cement the opinion of the judge that there was racial animus behind this entire piece of legislation. Hoppenthal called for, among other things, eliminating the use of Spanish in public life, except to identify items on menus in Mexican restaurants.
Really? Yes. Really? Amazing. Yes.
And he compared the teachers in your program, Curtis, to the KKK.
Yeah.
I mean, that's astonishing.
Also the Hitler youth army. I forgot what they were called. I don't want to just guess, but the Hitler Youth. We were also called that by him in a blog post.
And this seems to me to play into these long-held paranoid fears by a segment of white culture in the Southwest, which is that Mexico and by extension Mexican Americans harbor this long-held desire to reconquer the parts of Mexico that were lost to the United States. And to go so far as to compare what you're doing to the formulation of a young fascist army, that's astonishing to me.
Yeah. It was interesting living it. I tell you that. I mean, looking at it back now, I mean, it's so easy to laugh at it. But I was in the courtroom when his predecessor Tom Horn became our attorney general and actually argued early for the state in this case, or in the early stages of this case, and he went right to the KKK about us within 30 seconds of addressing Judge Tsushima back in like 2011, I believe. It was amazing just being in the room and just going, wow, really? And you're going to go there? I mean, I'm teaching the poetry. and they have us out in the desert with berets on, blindfolding our students, disassembling and assembling firearms by, you know, in order for the great Reconquista. I mean, it was right. And one of the things that is really important to emphasize is Mr. Horn especially never wanted to come to our classes, never wanted to talk with us. He just wanted to. He believed he knew everything from sources, many times unnamed, about what we were doing. And I think that shows something as well about who these folks were. But the anonymous blog post from Huppenthal also showed a clear state of mind towards Mexican Americans and Latinos as far as his own discriminatory and racist viewpoint.
I think it's really important to understand that this is, while the case you're talking about and the situation in Arizona is relatively unique, the fact of the matter is that we now have an administration that is so avowedly racist and so avowedly anti-Hispanic that it is really quite incredible. For me, as a person who thinks we should have long ago developed a bilingual curriculum for everybody, it is just really bizarre. And beyond that, it is very, very, very clear the essential racism, which translates into racism toward any and anti-person bias of any persons of color or different ethnicities or whatever. This is not just Arizona. Arizona might be the tip of the spear, but the fact of the matter is this is the movement, the fascist movement, that is attempting to take over the United States by force and violence.
Correct. I mean, I totally agree with you, Joe. And in fact, the day after the election, this past November, I wrote to my colleagues who were a little stunned across the country. I'm on a national advisory board for the Education for Liberation Network, and everybody was pretty stunned. And my response in our thread, our email thread, was "Welcome to the United States of Arizona." And then I thought about that more and more, and I'm like, I was in Napa Valley at the time because one of the things I do now is I'm an education consultant. So ironically, what was banned here in Arizona is what other school districts around the country are on fire for, right? And they should be, because it changed the lives of students that have been very, according to traditional education, have been difficult to reach. And what we showed was, no, they're not difficult to reach. You have to look at it through a different lens. And then it becomes quite easy to reach them, making up for the atrophy of skills that they may have received or not received up to the point is a different story. It's hard work, but for everybody, but for them to be engaged in school isn't as difficult as folks want to make it. But anyway, I digress. So I was in Napa Valley, and I was literally on election day. We do 2-day trainings and 2 successive days in a row with the same cohort. We do these deep dives. And so Tuesday was election day. We did day one. And then all of a sudden we woke up on Wednesday and I'm like, okay, I guess I got to change the morning, morning intro, because, you know, for me, it was just Wednesday. It was another day in the same thing. But for everybody else, I understood this was a moment, because Arizona, as you said, was the tip of the spear. We've been dealing with this and we've been surviving through it for a while now. I'm very proud of my colleagues and the plaintiffs of our lawsuit. I was a witness and all of us that kept fighting the fight and eventually got this victory. But there's ways to survive it, but it wasn't new to us. But I had to be empathetic for everybody else that was pretty probably stunned about the direction. But to go to just affirm your perspective, Joe, yes, this isn't the one thing about this election is I think it's a time. This administration, I shouldn't even say the election, this administration, there's nowhere to hide anymore. It's pretty clear. You have to like pick a side, you know, and what the sides aren't Republican and Democrat. The sides are humanity or inhumanity.
Well,
rhetoric, the venom, the poison that comes out. And now we're seeing it come out in action, you know, with what happened in Charlottesville, you know, and when what we see, what we even saw during Trump's campaign, his campaign, we saw how people were treated and intimidated. And that was happening to our students regularly as well. These aren't anomalies. This is a game plan. This is a strategy. And we have to, and I really firmly believe us, there's more of us that reject that. But we got to get there together. We got to start talking together. We got to be less afraid to talk about these things. We have to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. And that's something that I'm happy that I'm doing with some of my colleagues around the country. But we can't be everywhere, obviously. We all have to do this work. We have to start getting comfortable with the history of our country and what's happened and the institutional racism that we see. And also, one of the things I'm also really proud of is I was doing LGBT lit in the mid-2000s. Like, you know, I was creating, you know, I was making sure those voices were represented in my MAS literature classes. And that's all part of the same idea. The same as like, okay, if you understand you've been through this kind of discriminatory and oppressive experience, you're not alone. It's time to start looking with a wider lens upon your brothers and sisters that may be feeling this way too, and then be about the change. Because the other thing that we always would get hit with, and programs like ours around the country get hit with, is we're teaching victimization. No, we're teaching awareness so that you can go about changing that and living up to the tenets of this country.
We've got a caller, Barth. Good morning. What's on your mind?
Oh, the usual stuff. You know, the end of the world as we know it. I want to thank you for this guest. You know, we've been hearing remotely about this for years and years. Amy Goodman's done some good work on this, but the personal perspective and the in-depth discussion is really useful, because this is often painted from the other side, saying, "Oh, well, you know, they're anti-American and they're trying to, you know, polarize this group against other groups, and they're, you know, expressing, you know, what average folks might think of as, you know, contra thought to what is what makes a person an American, you know, separatism and pushing one culture over another. And I mean, it's very ironic that that's exactly what's happening up at the top now, but it's going in the other direction so violently. So this is great. I'm happy that your associate and friend was able to come in and give us the goods.
Me too.
And you ought to have him back for a pledge drive. I mean, this guy's good.
He is, yeah.
All right.
Thanks. Hey, thank you for the call. Appreciate
that. Talk to you later. Bye.
Let me ask you a Curtis, in the wake of this court ruling, it would appear that the ground has been cleared once again for more programs like the one you developed in Tucson. But at the same time, as we've been discussing, the current political climate has made it once again fashionable to be a racist and a fascist in public. So, you know, given the current conditions, what do you think the future holds for Mexican-American studies in Arizona?
Hermano, that's why there was so much on the line this last summer. I mean, just to really personalize this. So I was, you know, I was the first witness. And so I'm really thankful I was the first witness, too, because I got to spend a lot of time with our legal team. We had an amazing legal team, a collection of folks from New York, our own lawyer who had been us, Richard Martinez, from the start here in Tucson. Bob Chang up at Seattle University at the Korematsu Center. So it was great because we had this amazingly diverse legal team, and then the state of Arizona, you have two white folks over there during the trial. But I was able to, like, you know, really to spend some time with them and also calm myself down, which is like, because there's a lot on the line, which is like, okay, what happens if I screw this up? You know, and I had to come to grips with that. What happens if here I am at the goal line and I fumble, right? So I felt okay about the fact that I had done this for like over a decade. And that's just the struggle. That's not talking about being a teacher. I've done that for a lot longer. But I could forgive myself if I blew it somehow on the stand, but I wouldn't forget it ever. So I knew I had to bring it. And then the other thing I thought of is, okay, what if we lose? All right, so say I do well and we still lose. Say all my colleagues do well and we still lose, which is, you know, our lawyers were really straight up. They're like, Curtis, this is going to be a tough case to win. It's very hard to prove racial animus. They're like, we think we got it, but it's just, we just want you to be ready. And the other thing they said is they were really confident, Sean and I. Sean Arce was our director of MAS, and also he's one of my oldest friends in the struggle, and he was the best co-teacher I ever taught with. He taught the history, I taught the literature. And so we were the two teachers that were going to give voice to this on the stand. And he was really clear, like our lead attorney, Stephen Reese, he's like, we know who you are. We got the truth on our side. Just be yourself. Don't get nervous. Don't fall into those traps that so many times that's how cases are lost. You know, you may have been right, but you're not used to being cross-examined, right? You're not used to being in this high-pressure system. And he said that what he felt is that Judge Tashima was probably pretty clear that he had two ideologues on one side, but he didn't, meaning the former state superintendent, Horn and Hupital, but he didn't know what he had with us. So he goes, if he sees us as ideologues as well and not who we really were, educators, and who had loved our kids, who love our culture, who love everything about our history and who we are, and just were upstanding, we built a really solid program, then that would get us in the game. That doesn't mean we win. That just gets us in the game. But if we came off in another fashion, that's why he wanted us to relax and not argue or not get combative on the stand, just relax. Because he goes, be the teacher. Just be the teacher. By being the teacher, he was pretty clear that we were going to be able to at least be in the game. And so by winning this court case, we were able to, if we were to lose, our own community would have said, hey, man, they give it the best shot. It's a very Mexican story to give it your best shot and not win.
Well,
you know, we knew we would be forgiven. But what we were scared about is the precedent it would send for all these programs, these budding programs you're talking about, Abe. And now we got the victory, and now they're going to be okay.
Now, I do want to say one thing here. I think defensiveness is the mother of failure, as you suggest. And in fact, we who understand, and I don't mean to sound arrogant here, but I don't know how else to put it, we who understand the value of American multiculturalism, who understand the real history of the United States, and who understand the potential of this nation, and this is kind of a patriotism on my part, who understand these things, don't need to feel and should not feel, and as you suggest, will not feel, defensive. We got the right. We actually have the right on our side. And in fact, we are now facing the greatest challenge to American democracy in my lifetime and possibly in the history of the nation. And it's really, really important that we all understand, hey, with all the talk and all the argument about ideology and so on, we're right. And the fact of the matter is, they're wrong. And the fact of the matter beyond all that is, they're going to build a very, very bad society if we don't actively, brilliantly, and endlessly struggle for democracy.
Agreed.
Well, that brings us, I think, to the end of today's program. Curtis, we've had a request from a listener for contact information on you. Where can folks find out more about your work?
So they can look at they can look me up on Twitter at Curtis Acosta LLP, and they can also find our website for our consulting firm is Acosta Educational Partnership.
All right, Dr. Curtis Acosta, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for fighting the good fight down there in Arizona.
Hey, thank you so much, you and Joe, for inviting me, Abe. And I hope to see you soon, brother.
Likewise. Take care.
Con Dios.
All right. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. We will be back at you next week.
The program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
Donald Trump is no billionaire. He just plays one on TV. This is Greg Palast. On September 14th at 7 p.m., KBOO presents at the Clinton Theater the latest version of my new film. It's the world premiere of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, How Trump Stole It. The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, featuring Rosario Dawson, Willie Nelson, Richard Belzer, Ice-T, and Ed Asner as Santa Claus. That's The Best Democracy Money Can Buy world premiere of the new edition, How Trump Stole It. Again, that's KBOO at the